Hi, this is the Guitar Circle New England, and you're listening to Freeform Radio, 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford.
Good afternoon, and welcome to a special edition of In You All Along here on WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM, Tufts Freeform Radio. My name is Pete, and on this week's episode, I will be bringing you I don't know if this will be an annual tradition, but I did it last year. A look back at the life and work of none other than Joe Frank, a radio legend who passed away a year ago this week, and somebody who made a big impact on me and my interest in radio, and somebody who did some of the most amazing, lush and deeply descriptive radio that I've ever heard. I could keep being at a loss for words here and trying to tell you about it, or we could just have a radio show and you can hear for yourself. So let's do that.
Sharing the same coffin. There was a long entourage, a procession of at least 50 cars, and we all had our lights on. And a thunderstorm broke, and I was sitting in the hearse. It was also very hot, one of the hottest days of the year, and the air conditioning in the car had broken down, so I was bathed in sweat. And the driver, he looked like the devil. He was pale and thin with a sort of head that looks like a death's head. Very prominent teeth and jaws. And the rain was coming down heavily and the windshield wipers didn't work very well. And it was hard to see. And then the road ahead was washed out, and so the whole cortege had to take a detour and go over another smaller bridge further down the river. And we got lost, and this trip to the cemetery became a nightmare. that lasted for hours. We were consulting maps, stopping to ask directions. And then somebody got a flat tire, so the entire funeral cortege had to stop and wait while they fixed their tire. And the rain continued to pelt down. And then we drove over a rickety old broken-down bridge. And a minute later, I heard a cacophony of horns and cries behind me. And I stopped the car and I got out and I realized the bridge had collapsed and the last six cars had fallen into the river 100 feet below. And we tried to save the members of the party, many of whom had already drowned. Uncles, aunts, friends, people who were colleagues of my father. I could see cars upside down floating down the river, while others had simply disappeared beneath the water. And there was one car hanging half on the bridge, half over the water. And someone was crying out from the interior of the vehicle. And the valley was flooded. Animals and people standing on the roofs of houses. And so we continued toward the cemetery to bury my mother and father. But when we got there, all of the graves had been flooded, and coffins were floating away, caught in the river's current, with decomposed bodies and skeletons hanging out of them in crumpled heaps. And I stood there in the mud, watching this scene of devastation. And then I saw a beautiful wood-frame church in the distance, with a steeple and a bell tower, surmounted by a crucifix. And suddenly, two giant bolts of lightning streaked down, and there was a monstrous explosion that blossomed up to the sky, and the church was enveloped in flames, and people were running from it, their bodies on fire, flailing about wildly. And just then, a traffic helicopter crashed into a mausoleum, and two small children, very shabbily dressed, covered in mud, two little blonde, blue-eyed girls, emerged from the underbrush where they'd been hiding. And when they saw me, they started to throw stones and branches at me, calling me a Jew bastard. And I just stood there, not even ducking, not even feeling the blows. And it was then that I came to the realization that the world is evil. People talk about the benign indifference of the universe, but it didn't seem so benign to me. The universe was, in fact, malignant.
Thank you. I don't remember why we were being punished. It was something that probably children do often, like coming in late or for dinner or something. But anyway, we were exiled to the bedroom for a restriction period. My sister was about 5, and I was almost 8. And when we first got in the bedroom, we were very excited about the prospect of having to be cloistered in this little area for a long period of time. It was almost like an adventure. My mother was furious, and so we knew we were really in for a long time. So we cleaned our room up and we got all of our stuffed animals out, and we pretended we were mermaids, and the beds were the rocks and the floor was the water, and we were having a terrific time. And we'd only been in our room for a couple of hours when my mother stormed in the room, looked at both of us and said, "I've had it with the both of you. I want you to pack your bags, and I've decided I'm selling you to the gypsies." And, well, I knew she wasn't going to sell us to the gypsies. I mean, I knew by then, I understood a little bit about the world, and I knew that that just didn't happen. And I told my sister that when my mother shut the door and left. I said, "This isn't going to happen." So we didn't do anything. We thought she was just very angry. And we continued playing very quietly and just trying to be just very as unobtrusive as possible. And about 5 minutes later, she came back and said, "Well, aren't you packed yet?" And then I realized that she was serious, that she really wanted us to pack our things. So my sister, her name is Jeannie. Jeannie began to get very nervous and sort of clingy and whiny, you know, to me, after my mother left the room. And we packed our little bags. She and I together, we put our things in there. And the whole time I was telling her it was a big joke and nothing was going to come of it, and that she was just trying to scare us. Anyway, so she came in and grabbed our bags and sort of herded us out. And Jeannie was, her head, little head was craned, looking at me and looking at my mother. And I was making faces to her and shaking my head, saying, you know, in effect, not to worry and that things were going to be all right and not to be afraid. And I was holding her hand. And we got to the car and we put the bags in the back seat. And then Jeannie climbed in, and I got in the front seat, and my mother shut the door. And as she walked around the car to get in, Jeannie was whimpering and poking at my back, and I was so angry and so afraid of what was happening that I my whole back was stiff, and I couldn't even turn around and talk to her. I just said under my breath that not to be afraid, that everything was going to be all right, that we were probably going for a ride around the block. I remember saying that we were going for a ride around the block. So she started, my mother got in the car, her face was set, she didn't say a word to either one of us, and she just started the car and started driving. And I was sitting there very stern, not looking at her and not looking at Jeannie, and just looking out the window. And Jeannie began to whimper louder and louder in the back seat. She was poking me and crying to my mother, saying that she was sorry, that she was such a bad girl, and that she would never be bad again if we could only go home again. And what did her daddy think of all this? Does daddy know that you're selling us to the gypsies? And we had to stop at George's gas station, which was about 3 miles away from my parents' house. And at that point, I must say that I was getting a little ruffled, and I was, I think, crying a little bit, but still mute. And Jeannie by then was almost hysterical, with her arms drawn up and her legs drawn up, crying just pitifully. And my mother never, a muscle never moved in her face. Never moved in her face. When I looked at her, she was just as determined to frighten us as she was from the very beginning. But when we stopped at George's to get gas, it was George came up to the car. George was this wonderful old man that we'd known for years and years. And Jeannie was crying hysterically in the back seat. And I had tears running down my face and looking out the window, you know, taking furtive glances at my mother. And he asked what was wrong with Jeannie. And Jeannie was screaming that Mom was going to sell us to the gypsies. And old George had his arm up on the window and always thought my mother was just the most wonderful and most beautiful woman in the world. And, your mommy wouldn't do that. Your mommy's not selling you to the gypsies. And Jeannie, her eyes were so... She jumped up from the back seat and was clinging to the side of the door saying, yes, she is. She's selling us to the gypsies. We're going to the gypsies now. See, our suitcases are in the back seat. And at that point, my mother finally, she decided, I guess, that it had gone too far. And what it was that we were doing and where it was that we were going was to my Aunt Margaret's house, where we went every summer for 2 weeks. And the relief was astounding. I leapt up out of the seat and turned around to Jeannie and screamed. I could hardly contain myself. See, I told you. I knew we weren't going to the gypsies. Tears streaming down my face, a big smile, an evil smile. I could feel my lips barred with the glee of knowing that I was right.
Were a couple of excerpts of Joe Frank programs, most of which ran about an hour long. I wish that we could just run those every week, and then would save me a lot of trouble. But in the meantime, we just heard an excerpt from a program from Joe's 1999 series, which was called The Other Side. These were on the radio on KCRW in LA, and then they would be syndicated to various other stations. I used to hear Joe on WFMU in New Jersey, and it was something that I just discovered randomly. I just totally... I actually heard of Joe Frank, and I didn't really know who he was, and then I heard this thing on the radio, and it was mesmerizing. Like, I was just gripped. It was like we had a car full of people driving up the Merritt Parkway or the Connecticut Turnpike or something, and this program of his called The Dictator, it was a three-part show, came on the radio, and it was about a man living deep underground and intimating that he had control over all the events on the surface, and you didn't know if he was crazy or it was real. Somebody told me later that there was a movie from Hungary, I think, that was or Czechoslovakia or someplace, that was a very similar story. So I don't know if it was based on that, but it was an excellent, vivid description. And so then I just I delved in again and again. And I was hooked, and I've always been hooked, on long drives, sitting home alone. Once I sat down with a friend on the couch, and Joe Frank was on, and we just sat there silent for an hour, and just got lost. Just got lost in the pictures that were painted in our minds. So anyway, that was an excerpt from Woman and Bull and Paint Factory. which was from the Other Side series. Prior to that, we heard Sampaguita from a band called Ultra from their 2018 release called Nali. Before that, we had Joe Frank with an excerpt from a story called Mountain Rain, one of my favorites, from the 1996 program Somewhere Out There. And we opened with Sonic Youth with their song Tremens off 1997's Anagramma EP. That was a series of these little, very noisy, out there releases they did, each one a different color, when they really started delving into the experimental side of things. Behind me right now is Alone Again So, a piece by Kid Loco, which I included because it was the background from one of Joe Frank's shows, a program called Fat Man Down, which gives me chills, brings me to the brink of tears, and captures my imagination every time. That said, let's listen to a little bit more of Joe Frank.
Sidebar with the jukebox playing country and western music. The room is decorated for Halloween. There are witches on broomsticks fanned across a wall, and jack-o'-lanterns with lit candles on the tables. The place is crowded with people in costumes. There's a wolf man, a pirate, a Keystone cop, someone wearing a Nixon mask. At the end of the bar, I see a young woman sitting alone, dressed as Christ. She's wearing a robe tied around her waist with a rope sash, a crown of thorns, and a pair of sandals. Her shoulder-length sandy-colored hair, parted down the middle, lies flat against her head, and she has a false mustache and beard. I can see stigmata on the palms of her hands. I walk over and slide onto the stool beside her. "So you're celebrating," I say. "Celebrating? No, there's nothing to celebrate this evening," she says. "Well, what about your costume?" "It's not a costume," she says. "This is the way I dress." "Really? Hey, I earned these clothes," she says. I ask her, "Would you like another drink?" "No, I'm fine." "How about some loaves and fishes?" "Is that a joke?" she says. "I guess so." "So you've read the Bible then?" "Some," I say. "As a literary work or as a sustaining work of survival? I mean, are you one of those scholars that studies it and dissects it without ever taking anything in?" "You're pretty smart," I say. "For a crackpot in a bar," she asks. "Is that where they put the nail through your hand?" "Yes," she says. "I bled for your sins. I don't really know if it was worth it. "What's it like to be crucified?" I say. "Haven't you ever been in love?" she asks. "No." "Well, I'm surprised. I mean, you're not a child. How have you shielded yourself? Are you a coward?" "I don't think so," I say. "Too busy?" she asks. Then she sighs and says, "Look, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude. It's just that I've had to get the money lenders out of the temple today and perform many miracles." "Like?" I ask. "Like, for instance, I got up and got out of bed this morning. And I answered the phone having no idea who'd be on the other end. That was quite a leap of faith, wouldn't you say? I mean, are you ever attacked by your phone?" "I don't have a phone," I say. "Why's that?" "I'm on the road." "Oh," she says, "a pilgrim." I lift my drink and take a sip and gaze around the room. "I always thought Jesus was a man," I say. "But it's hard to tell with you. Are you a hermaphrodite?" "No, I am, in fact, a woman," she says. "Well, what about the beard?" "I have a weak chin," she says. "A beard really helps me. It gives me an authority I otherwise lack. And I just find I get further in life with this beard. Still, it's a little distracting," I say. "Well, it doesn't come off for you or anybody."
Chasing my dreams. least I'm known I tried. And I drown it in my fabricated alibis. If I fail, chances pass me by, as the chances pass me by.
There is a wise man in a hut in a deep jungle darkness, or on an island in the midst of a great salt lake, or in an apartment building in a slum in Bombay. Or maybe he has no home and wanders from city to city. But it would certainly be good to find him wherever he is. Or perhaps the answer lies behind a door, down a corridor, through a series of subway tunnels, and beneath a labyrinth of crisscrossing steam and electrical service ventilators, up out of a manhole into the shadow of a great cathedral, where, in the vestry, in the lower left-hand drawer of a desk, I will find the key to a code in a computer chip which will provide a printout whose interpolation by a group of mathematically advanced Tibetan monks will produce a street map of downtown Rio de Janeiro, where a telephone will be ringing. And if I pick up that phone, I'll be given directions for a taxi ride to the docks, where a blue houseboat will be waiting. But this will not be the boat I should get on. It will be a decoy. And I will stand there and watch it depart, because 5 minutes after that boat leaves, a second boat will dock. I'll be able to identify it because it will be a 28-foot skiff with a hardwood deck, flying the colors of the Vatican, cross keys against a golden background, and piloted by a man wearing a leather circa 1932 football helmet to which horns have been glued, as if to reproduce the image of ocean-going Vikings. But this will not be the boat either. However, if I look carefully, tied by a single strand of worn rope, I'll see a small dinghy bobbing in the waves beside the dock. But I must turn my back on this, too, to find a nondescript step van approaching, pulled by a single rickshaw driver in full harness, horseshoes nailed to the bottom of his sandals. And I will climb into this vehicle, and once inside, I will hear a radio tuned to a popular Brazilian station. I will listen very carefully to the telephone numbers given by the disc jockey, spoken in Portuguese. He will give 8 dozen telephone numbers, and I will listen for the one number that, when each digit is added up, equals 57. And having identified this number using the Cyrillic alphabet, assigning numbers 1 through 28 for each letter a number, I will determine the address of the sanctuary where I will ultimately find peace. So, It's not an impossible task. It takes a certain amount of dedication and effort, but it's easily doable. The journey to the sacred might begin at a bus station, or at a river's edge, or in a room with a day bed, the window overlooking a store that sells bulk quantity pet food. Or the search for the sacred might begin at a Kmart, in the home furnishing department, sitting in a lawn chair, listening to the Leroy Anderson Orchestra play Winter Wonderland, when the music abruptly stops and you hear a voice on the PA system say, "Would Michael G. come from the stockroom to cashier's position number 6, please?" Or the journey to the sacred might begin at Bob's Big Boy, at a breakfast to celebrate the hiring of a new regional sales manager. There are 5 people at the table, 2 brand managers, an account executive, the merchandising manager, and the district sales coordinator. And everyone is eating a huge hungry man's breakfast with eggs, pancakes, bacon, sausage, muffins, and grits. The waitress repeatedly returning to freshen the cups, adding an element of unpredictability and threatening the psychic architecture of the situation and creating an emotional house of cards, causing everyone to nervously and feverishly add sugar and cream to their coffees. The moment of crisis coming when the district sales coordinator covers his cup only to have the waitress pour the coffee on the back of his hand, scalding him because she's been momentarily distracted by a handsome young man with shoulder-length blonde hair, who's just entered the restaurant and glanced her way. Michael Bolton.
On the love between us, good times are a treat, something we appreciate when the gods conspire to gently treat us. I call it the kicker when it oozes out of every corner. You know it oozes out of every corner. Your life to be easier at least. Let the generation speak. Somebody steal your voice. You wrestle to the ground by the devil melancholy of. I call it the kicker. Watch out, it'll make it bitter. Watch out, it'll make it bitter. And here comes the kicker. It oozes out of every corner. It oozes out of every corner. Thank you.
hope you're all enjoying this sedate hour of In You All Along. A little more sedate than sometimes. There's always room for sedation. On the radio. We just heard from Hybrasil with their song, The Kicker, from the album of the same name from 2002. I played that because... Why was that? Why did I? I'm going to tell you, they're playing. It has left my view. It always works this way, doesn't it? But those guys are playing in a big production this week. And I'm going to get you the details on that really soon. Before that, we heard from Joe Frank yet again with an excerpt from his program Bible Salesman from the 1996 series Somewhere Out There. Before that, we heard from Stone the Druggist with Pass Me By from their album, their self-titled album from this year, from 2018. No, it's not this year. That's last year. I'm doing the radio equivalent of putting the wrong date on a check. So Stone the Druggist will be playing on Sunday the 20th, this Sunday, at the Midway Cafe at 4 p.m. with American Ink, The Moon Watch, and Friday Life. And we opened that set with a Joe Frank excerpt from his work called Three Shingles, about a man who meets a woman dressed as Jesus Christ at a bar. And that's also from the Somewhere Out There series from 1996. I've got a whole bunch of stuff to tell you guys. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. You know, we have a few obligations down here. We have to tell you what you're listening to. We're asked to let you know the names of the songs, and we're required to let you know the name of the radio station. One thing we're required to do is read your public service announcement once every hour. If you ever become a DJ down here, and you are welcome to do that, you will learn all this and you'll be quizzed on it. So I'm giving you a few advanced study tips. Public service announcement every hour. Station ID, top of the hour. But once a week, I have to tell you something about something like Food Not Bombs, which is a loose-knit group of independent collectives serving free vegan and vegetarian food to others. Food Not Bombs recovers and shares free vegan or vegetarian food with the public without restriction in over 1,000 cities around the world to protest war, poverty, and the destruction of the environment. Each group is independent and invites everyone to participate in making decisions for their local chapter using the consensus process. Food Not Bombs is dedicated to taking nonviolent direct action to change society so no one is forced to stand in line to eat at a soup kitchen, expressing a commitment to the fact that food is a right and not a privilege. For more information, visit foodnotbombs.net. This has been a public service message from Food Not Bombs and WMFO in Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. We are rapidly approaching the end of the hour here, so let us move things right along with a little bit more of the local favorites. Okay, that's going to about wrap it up for this week. We just heard from Shepherdess with their song Wrong Not Right from 2013's I'm Saving Myself for Shepherdess. Those guys are playing this week. They're playing on Saturday with Dowager and the Sweats at the Midway Cafe. Prior to that, we heard from Forktie, who are also playing this week. We heard from their song Decomposition Book from 2018's EP called EP. And they are playing tomorrow night, Friday, at O'Brien's with Knockover City and Ghosts of the Atlantic. Earlier, I had mentioned Hybrisilla playing in a big shebang. That is at the Burren Back Room on Sunday, the 4th annual Jeff Berlin fundraiser for children's, teens, and families who are facing cancer and other serious related chronic illnesses. That features the Royer Family Band, Abby Barrett, Bo Thayer, Jeff Berlin, Jeremy Moses Curtis, Andrea Gillis, Ally McGurk, and the Silks. It starts at 3:30 p.m. and it goes apparently forever with all that music. Sounds like a great time, definitely a great cause, worth dropping on down there. The ticket is a steal for all the great music you're going to get. That's going to do it for me. Thank you for tuning in yet again to In You All Along here on WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM Tufts Freeform Radio. Stay tuned for Alex and the Desperate Hours coming up next.